Cross-chain problem is something that has been very close to me. I remember using Shapeshift quite a lot back in the day when I thought it was awesome that one could just request an address to send some Bitcoin to and get Ethereum and vice versa. And that service went away with KYC. It became much less useful. What we now call DeFi, but wasn't really a thing at that point. It was sort of something that was loosely talked about, but it wasn't until later that year that really kicked off and we saw Uniswap really take off and all of the associated products that came along with that. You know, the thesis around the cross-chain side of things became very clear that, okay, this has now happened to Uniswap. We'd already been writing this research paper on ThorChain, or based on the ideas around ThorChain, should I say. We sort of took a first principles basis.
This podcast is sponsored by CoinATM Radar. When buying crypto with cash, an ATM is much more reliable and safer than meeting some random person in a random place. And unlike an exchange, which could freeze your account, you truly own all the crypto you buy. With CoinATM Radar, you could find crypto ATMs and other services where you can buy and sell cryptocurrencies for cash. On their website, you can search by coin, address, if the ATM supports selling as well as buying, and you can also search by geo area. Country, state, city. You can also check and compare actual current fees at different ATMs. If you want to find out more, head over to coinatmradar.com, which is coinatmradar.com. Hey everyone, I have the fantastic pleasure of speaking with the one and only Simon Harman of Chainflip. How's it going, man?
Very well, thanks. Yourself?
Very good. It's something I've, as I was mentioning earlier, I definitely have been looking forward to this for a long time because somewhere in 2021 or so, I got introduced to ThorChain in the ChaosNet days, and it just, DeFi for me personally never made sense. Like I didn't care about it really until it was with real L1 native assets and nothing wrapped. And so I kind of went down this big old rabbit hole, and then the Maya protocol came out later, and I got heavily involved with that project and trying to get them onboarding new chains such as Dash, for example. And then, of course, I hear about Chainflip. And then I hear about Sarai Dex maybe on the future. And so at this point, I'm trying to make sure to connect everything to where I know what everything's doing, while all the cool possibilities out there. I'm very glad that it's not just one project or even two anymore. I'm glad that there's redundancy to the redundancy and some extra new things. So that's kind of where my whole curiosity in this thing came in. So why don't you really quick introduce yourself and how you got into crypto?
Yeah, sure. I bought Bitcoin in high school in 2014 for reasons that still escape me. Me and my best friend were super into philosophy and economics and a bunch of other very nerdy things for 16, 17 year olds. And been working on like modding games and stuff like that. So very technologically engaged. And at some point, Bitcoin entered our awareness. And yeah, from there, we just thought it was really cool and started buying it. And, you know, that's how it all began. And then over the years, you know, then the following year, you know, bought Ethereum at $1, sold it at $2, thought everything was great. Many, many ups and downs, of course, but the sort of first major step that I took to really get more involved in the space beyond just sitting on the sidelines and being involved in trading and so on, was when I founded Loki in 2017. It's a privacy project. We built a secure messaging app called Session, which now has around about 1 million monthly active users, which is amazing. It's kind of like Signal, but the whole back end is powered by a decentralized network that's coordinated on a blockchain and end-to-end encryption and all that kind of stuff, but there's no phone numbers, no emails, no nothing like that. So that was a long 3-year journey and a long story that's still going on today. My co-founders are still down there in Australia, still working on it. So and it's going pretty well. So not to dwell too much on that, I guess, you know, where we come to Chainflip, you know, at this point I'd already founded one project, set up a whole team, built something fairly sustainable, but financially things were not looking great when COVID hit. You know, I'm sure we all remember that day. That if you would, well, everyone does, because it wasn't just crypto. It was every Bitcoin hit $3,000 on some exchanges, and we were, you know, somewhat concerned that, you know, our financial position wasn't going to be enough to sustain the project for much longer, given the circumstances. And so that sort of spurred on thinking about, you know, what else could we be doing to sustain the team and sustain the project? What could we be adding to this to sort of capture new markets while Session develops? Because at the time, I think it had only just come out, or it hadn't come out yet. So it was, you know, very early days there too. So the cross-chain problem is something that, as a user of crypto, has been something that has been very close to me. I remember using Shapeshift quite a lot back in the day in the Exodus wallet and on the main interface itself. And I thought it was awesome that one could just, you know, request an address to send some Bitcoin to and get Ethereum and vice versa. And that service went away with KYC. It became much less useful. Couldn't be interacted with programmatically. And products like that still exist today, like Changely and stuff. But, you know, I think clearly the thesis that that wasn't as useful for what we now call DeFi, but wasn't really a thing at that point. It was sort of something that was loosely talked about, but it wasn't until later that year that that really kicked off, and we saw Uniswap really take off, and all of the associated products that came along with that, and the real financialization of blockchains in an on-chain sense. And so, you know, the thesis around the cross-chain side of things became very clear that, okay, this has now happened to Uniswap. We'd already been writing this research paper on ThorChain, or based on the ideas around ThorChain, should I say. We sort of took a first principles basis, because one of the main things we were looking at was this memoless transactions feature that ThorChain didn't have. How could that be done? So generating a deposit address, which will then trigger a swap. So you don't have to connect your wallet. It can come from any arbitrary place. It can be interacted with programmatically. You know, that was something that was very interesting to us. So that's sort of the premise that we started with. And yeah, split the project off eventually, realizing the magnitude of the project upon which we were about to embark. And so Chainflip became its own thing in like September of 2020, I think. And then from there, it has been a constant battle to get this thing out into the world. And finally, after some fundraising rounds, lots of team building, and many, many years of development work from a bunch of people that are way smarter than me. Yeah, it's been amazing to see that we actually hit our first $1 million in swap volume today. So,
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. We thought we were going to do $1 million just today as well. Like, things really took off, but I don't know if we're going to make it by the time the day's over, but we'll see. It's looking good. But yeah, that's kind of the basic outline of my journey into this and how I ended up here. So, you know, in total, it's been over 6-7 years, something like that, working on this stuff full time as a founder and trying to build these projects and in particular trying to build products that are actually useful has been a focus of mine. You know, with the secure messaging, for example, that's inherently useful. And then with this, obviously, there's such a huge addressable market for L1 swaps, as you describe, especially with these native flows. So, this has been sort of my driving factor for continuing to work in the space. Obviously, there's a lot of fluff. There's a lot of other things going on. But, you know, from a sustainability perspective, it's the protocols like Uniswap and Aave and many others that really people use on a day-to-day basis that no matter what comes and goes, no matter what the future use cases end up being, you know, this is all infrastructure, if you want to use that word, that supports that. And I think that's above all what's needed to really keep the space going and improve the actual user experience so that other possibilities may arise which generate further utility for people out there in the world with the technology that we're working on.
Yeah. So what do you heard about ThorChain when you read the white paper, etc. So I assume that's before there was anything concrete to ThorChain, right? There was no testnet or chaosnet or anything then, or was it early days of
ThorChain? I actually knew about ThorChain before pretty much anyone, I want to say. I was the guy who sort of put together the idea at in the beginning. I won't say his name because I don't think he really wants to be known as this. But it was for a Binance hackathon, like 200 meters down the road from my house in Melbourne, where he first came up with the idea. But at the time, the technology to pull it off just did not exist, like straight up. The threshold signature schemes that ThorChain now uses were not a thing at that time. So it wasn't even possible. So I just kind of went, okay, that's cool, man. Like, good luck. And a couple of years later, it's like, oh, wow, okay, this has advanced quite a bit. Started looking into the threshold signature schemes that were involved and realized pretty quickly that, okay, things have advanced along quite a bit. And by the time we started writing our research paper on it, a new threshold signature scheme had been proposed called Frost, which relies on Schnorr signatures, which GG20 does not, which is the one ThorChain is based on. I think Frost is much faster and much more efficient, but the downside of it is it relies on Schnorr signatures. And so without that being supported by Bitcoin, it wasn't really possible for anyone like ThorChain to come along and do it until much later. So I think, that's a unfortunate reality there, but it just goes to show that this cryptography is very, very new. And these products are a product of their time. They're using really cutting edge stuff and using ideas that are being created in real time. So, it's not like ThorChain or Chainflip could have showed up in 2013. They were just, 2014, 2015, all the way right up until 2018. There was just not the know-how in the world to be able to pull it off in the way that we have. I've been following ThorChain for a long time, basically.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So does that mean that you started on Chainflip before ThorChain was a thing, or it was already starting to become a thing? It was already in progress.
It was already starting to become a thing. It was before the ChaosNet days. This was in 2020. So I think at this point, Rune was a token. And there was sort of a blueprint about how it would work. And I think some code had been written, but to my knowledge, I think ChaosNet came the following year in 2021.
Yeah. And so what made you decide to, rather than just hop on board and try to weasel your way into the ThorChain development team or whatever and support that, what made you decide, you know what, this is cool, but I think I want to do something different?
Well, I mean, that's kind of why we came at it from a first principles basis. We didn't read the white paper. All we'd had is someone explaining it to us on a whiteboard. And that was enough for us to, spur our interest and think a bit deeper about it. So we read this research paper over a couple of months, like how would we do it? In particular, we were focusing on this Schnorr signature scheme and the depositless transaction side of things as well. And then we fleshed out the rest of the system and then went back, looked at ThorChain's design, looked at where it was at with the code at the time and kind of just went, this is different enough that it makes sense to not, I guess, borrow anything from ThorChain. There's differences in these designs all up and down. There's advantages to each, but we think this is something that we can work on independently. And like you say, it is with this kind of opportunity in the market, there's definitely a lot of utility in having multiple designs. Absolutely. For example, you look at AMMs for instance, Bancor created them, but they were certainly not the last to iterate on it. And still, there are still further innovations happening all the time across multiple teams with, Curve and Uniswap and Sushi and, a whole bunch of other teams trying new market structures, new protocols of achieving a similar effect. But the methods sort of competing with each other in the open market is what has really driven the space forward. And so I think, from my perspective, I was really interested in, sort of doing things in that vein and trying to create an alternative that may or may not yield further benefits for users.
Yeah, that makes sense. So structurally, how different is Chainflip from ThorChain? Would you mind just quickly breaking down, the structures of each and what are the key differences and how they function?
Sure thing. So at a high level, they're quite similar. So if I had to explain it very simply, it would be, imagine there is sort of a decentralized network and it controls very large multisigs, which exist on multiple blockchains at once. And the whole network watches all of the external blockchains, it controls all of these external wallets, and then sort of uses that to settle into an internal trading system, effectively, which allows users to send and receive assets from any of these chains, which are then swapped through the internal accounting system and then egressed out to wherever they need to go. At a high level, we have a blockchain. It coordinates all of that. We have threshold signature schemes that allows for this sort of decentralized custody model, which allows for this native swapping that is sort of the key differentiating factor between this and other protocols. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there is differences everywhere between Chainflip and Thorchain. Sometimes small differences, sometimes fairly large differences. I mentioned the threshold signature scheme as one of the key differences. But you know, from a user perspective, no one really cares about that. It means that, you know, Chainflip, for example, has atomic vault rotations. All 150 validators participate in all of the signing ceremonies all of the time. Mm. Whereas Thorchain is broken up into many, many smaller vaults, which in turn control portions of the liquidity at a time, which is done so to make the GG20 algorithm viable. Because if you tried to do a key generation ceremony in GG20 with 150, it would fail almost every time, I imagine. I haven't tried, but because the key ceremony is so much longer, there's so much more scope for a single party failing to disrupt the whole ceremony and make it start again, which is what happens. So, you know, this threshold signature stuff is actually way more complicated than people realize. It's something that took us about 18 months to do, and a lot of trial and error. It's not easy. So, you know, that's one difference. It means that all of liquidity is controlled by the whole protocol the whole time versus Thorchain, where it's fragmented. There's advantages to that, of course, but from a user perspective, not a huge difference. What does make a bit larger difference is the market structure. So for example, Thorchain, everything's backed against Rune, and there's V2 liquidity pools, there's arbitrage going on there through, I think they call them synths, and you know, a variety of other mechanisms in order to achieve the swaps on the back end through accounting. We have a much simpler system. Everything's backed in USD, which is generally how the markets are structured anyway. And we have developed something called the JIT AMM, which combines limit orders and sort of a V3 style Uniswap thing. That's all mathematically integrated. It's very efficient. It's very cool. No one probably cares, but I think it's cool. But the crux of it is that, you know, we're able to fill orders very, very quickly and very efficiently with a very small amount of capital, relying more on professional market makers and algorithmic trading, rather than sort of passive liquidity, which is then in turn arbitraged by professional operators. So there's professional operators involved in both in the end. I think the original vision of Thorchain is that it would just be passive liquidity. In reality, that is so not how it works. And we sort of just accepted that reality a long time ago and fully have leaned into it, which has changed the market structure, meaning that we think we'll be probably able to offer some more efficient routes for a lot of different swaps, depending on what it is. What else? Many other differences. We have share no code with Thorchain is an interesting one. Zero lines, totally different framework, totally different language, not same, different cryptography, like nothing in common whatsoever. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? I mean, some would argue that, you know, Thorchain has been tried and tested at this point. To some extent, there's, you know, some benefits that come along with that. On the other hand, it's meant that we've been able to totally architect this thing from scratch and sort of learn from a lot of what has happened in the early Thorchain days in order to sort of make Chainflip a bit more modular and also lighter weight, because we know what is needed and we know what is not. We use Substrate, not Cosmos. I don't know if I enjoy that decision in the end, but that's a story for another time. Lots of differences everywhere you look, from the way validators are staked. We have an auction system, for example, through to how penalties are issued, how swap rates are calculated, how just everything's different. But at the end of the day, the net result is pretty similar. And conceptually, it's the same idea implemented in two very different ways.
So it could be thought of maybe as a multiversal Thor chain, where somewhere in the multiverse, instead of Chad and his merry band of people making that, then there's someone else doing kind of the exact same thing, but kind of in very different ways. Just, it's like a different way this could have turned out somewhere in the multiverse, sort of. But we're lucky enough to have both of them in one universe.
Yeah, it's something like that. I think, though, because we were slightly behind Thorchain, though, we have sort of the benefit of knowing about their struggles and knowing about what they've been able to teach the space in terms of what works and what doesn't. So I think we've been the benefactor of a lot of hard work from those guys as well. So maybe not totally parallel, but yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, well, before going deeper onto that point, what about the tokenomics? So I'm sure there's a token, right? And then I'm sure that bonds nodes or something like that. How is that whole thing different from Thorchain? Because that's also the biggest difference between Thorchain and the Maya protocol is the whole tokenomic structure. And so that's something I find personally fascinating.
Yeah. So I think, yes, you're right. They're bonded. There's an auction system we have in place. We designed a new auction style to suit this 150 validator network. There's a big difference, though, in the way that the markets are structured. So Flip is not used as the base pair of liquidity for everything inside Chainflip. That's a key difference. We've kind of said, okay, the token is to secure the protocol, and that's about it. It doesn't need to do anything else. That also does mean, though, that it's used to pay for gas on the Chainflip state chain, sorry, an internal blockchain. So all the LPs, when they update and stuff, there's like, it's a spam protection thing. It's not really meant to be for generating or capturing value or whatever. That comes in something we call the network fee. So anytime a swap comes through, it'll hit USDC. And when it does, we'll take 10 bips of that, so 0.1%, and we will put that aside and use it to buy and burn Flip internally within the system. So we're offsetting emissions with essentially a sort of protocol usage fee. And then there's liquidity fees and other things on top of that. But essentially that's the model. So pretty simple. A nice thing about the buy and burn, unlike a lot of other protocols that don't have their own internal DEX, is that, you know, where it's actively contributing towards that demand side for the token, whereas a lot of others, that's either has to be managed by a foundation or something like that, or it's just burning an offsetting supply by itself, which is fine. But that's sort of the basic token economic model. And I think that, you know, as we see volumes increase across the DEX space, particularly this side of the DEX space, I think that'll prove to be something really exciting. I mean, Ethereum's model, the sort of a rough inspiration for how this was going to work. You know, you take the gas fees, you burn it, and hopefully that'll offset the emissions such that you introduce scarcity. That's really where we want to be. Obviously, right now with volumes being tiny, we are far from that point. But hopefully in the near future, that'll be something that all stakeholders can benefit from equally. So there's no really any special action required. Obviously, those that are securing the network are going to have more tokens, but apart from that, it's distributed to all holders equally. And that's really it, unless you have other questions about the tokenomics you want to know.
Yeah, so liquidity providing, is it a dual asset kind of a model? I know it's not, doesn't use the Flip token, but is it still like a dual asset model, or is it kind of single-sided?
Doesn't have to be. It's pretty much a centralized exchange. If you check out the LP dashboard, you'll see you can place limit orders, range orders, and on either side or both sides or no side, you know. So there's no dual or single LP. It's very free. You can do whatever you want. And it's mainly geared towards, though, professional market makers. I say market makers, but in reality, it's a, kind of a different strategy to that. I don't know if you're familiar with Uniswap X or CowSwap by any chance.
No, not too closely, no.
All right, so CowSwap is what you would call an intent-based swap protocol. It's built by Gnosis. Cow stands for coincidence of wants. the original idea was if you have one trader going this way and another trader coming the other way with the other asset, you know, you guys could cancel each other out and you'd both save money. It would be great. In reality, that doesn't happen often enough to be actually useful. But what they did also do is introduce this intent-based system where effectively you have these algorithmic traders out there who they're called solvers in this context. But what they do is they essentially, a swap will come in and then the solvers will have an opportunity to fill some of that liquidity at a price better than what can be offered on something like Uniswap. So what they actually then do is they source quotes in real time from the centralized order books, prime brokers, other AMMs, whatever the case may be, and they put forward a price for the asset before it is actually swapped. So it's kind of this auction process that's being run there. And when that is over, one or more of the solvers will provide liquidity at a price better than what you would be able to otherwise achieve, because they're aggregating liquidity across not just one or two liquidity pools, but literally the entire global market and competing with each other on offering the best rate. So those intent-based systems, I think, are absolutely the future of on-chain trading. And that is how Chainflip works, essentially. Because we have this very free liquidity provision system, particularly with the limit orders, but then maker-only limit orders is something that's also noteworthy. So if you come to me and you say, I want to sell one Bitcoin, what will then happen is the LPs will then actually be given some time because of the ingress delay to respond to that. And they will put forward limit orders as aggressively as they can to win the liquidity fee. So it's kind of like this constant auction that's taking place for any and all user swap flow, meaning that there is this sort of front-running game that's happening, but unlike a lot of front running, which is generally associated with bad things happening, this is actually very much in the user's favor because it's the LPs trying to beat each other to offer the best price. And that's where the just in time and the JRT AMM comes forward. They're trying to offer the best price just in time before the swap goes through. And through this system, we think that we're going to be able to offer zero slippage rates, basically up to the extent that LPs are willing to keep capital in the system for all pools across all markets, which is really exciting. So that's a pretty major difference in liquidity model and something that we have been very excited about since we first wrote about it 2 years ago. And it's finally in the wild and it's working, which is great. Yeah,
that's pretty great. Now, as far as the security of liquidity, et cetera. So Thorchain, obviously, the reason behind the dual asset, one of the big reasons is so that nodes have no incentive to collude and steal from pools, right? That's kind of the reason why it's like half ruined, because then they would wreck their investment in order to, if they wanted to collude and steal. What's kind of the parallel for Chainflip? How does Chainflip not having that now prevent nodes colluding and stealing and things like that?
Oh, it's no different, really. I mean, they all hold Flip. And there's plenty of protections in place. It'd be very easy to detect if it did happen. I've written a very long economic security article on this exact question, 14 pages long, and there's a lot of considerations in place. But there is a limit. You have to put in quite a lot of liquidity for it to make sense for a group of validators to collude. I mean, for starters, we're dealing with super majorities of 66% here to be able to actually steal. You know, we have this 2 of 3 sort of ratios, 100 of 150. So you have to get quite a lot of people to collude to get this to work. And for it to make economic sense, there's a range of factors that you have to consider as to, you know, what is the threshold of value stored in the protocol that you would have to cross to make it sort of even break even. To conduct that attack. And then there's a lot of other factors involved as well, like, you know, reputational risk, because this is all very public, you know, criminal liability, so on and so on.
Yeah, of course.
There's a range of things involved here. The benefit of, like, that sounds kind of scary, but the truth is every decentralized system is not truly decentralized if there isn't some way for a majority or a super majority to steal everything. That's kind of the definition of decentralization, right? It can't be, there is no, you know, monarch at the top of the pile that has the final say in everything. Otherwise, it just wouldn't be what it is. So, you know, this is a reality that we've known about since the very beginning and something we thought a lot about. But to be frank, the level of liquidity that we would have to be storing to be for this to even be remotely a concern is currently sitting, hang on, I can tell you, auctions.chainflip.io. You can see the total amount staked. In my estimation, it's probably about 1-to-1. So right now, Project Global Lockup, we can secure about $112 million of non-flip assets in the exchange quite comfortably before this even becomes remotely a concern. And then on top of that, we also have a security ratio. To be honest, it's not something we've yet implemented because we are very far away from reaching that 112 million limit. But we have a plan for when we start to, which is basically we force all LPs to provide a refund address. So if we end up with excess liquidity, we can actually just send dead liquidity back to whoever owns it automatically out of the protocol. So we can always stay in an economically secure state, no matter what the value of flip is, no matter what the amount of lockup that we have in the validators is, and so on. So, it's a really interesting topic. There's a lot of theory around it, but I think practically speaking, the real threat to liquidity in these systems is not that sort of hypothetical supermajority collusion attack, but, you know, is it hackable? Can a single actor, you know, manipulate something in order to extract value from the network without having to own flip at all? That's really, I think, the number one concern that I have had, and I think others should think about more closely when considering the security implications of storing liquidity inside the protocol.
Yeah, it's so, as far as the mistakes, or I wouldn't say mistakes, as far as the lessons that Thorchain learned the hard way by kind of going first, that you've been able to observe and, I guess, maybe do better than, that we haven't covered already. Are there any more that come to mind?
Not immediately. I mean, I guess you're alluding to maybe some of the exploits that occurred in the ChaosNet days of Thorchain. Obviously, that was pretty scary to watch, I suppose. From our perspective, we were not super thrilled that it was happening, of course, but at the same time, a lot of that stuff was going on
during that time too.
Yeah,
so I lost out on a lot of, like, when ETH was down for months, I lost out on a lot of potential gains from experimenting with LPs on that, but, you know, no regrets. Yeah. I was happy to be part of that grand experiment.
So I guess you know, something we were always going to do from the get-go was, you know, be pretty strict about our audits and be very strict around our code practices as well. So, you know, I think this is a very long conversation about how you build dev teams and how you conduct code reviews and, you know, what standards you should uphold internally. Something that, like, no one on Twitter really talks about because no one on Twitter knows what the hell they're talking about anyway. But, you know, there's multiple ways of going about developing a crypto project. And I think most of it is shoot from the hip, frankly speaking. I'm not saying this is necessarily what happened with Thorchain, but to be frank, at the time, I imagine things are a lot better now, but I think at the time, if you look at some of the code that was exploited, it was pretty clear that those sort of processes really were not in place. And there wasn't anyone sort of taking a look to find them because, frankly speaking, a couple of them were really basic. And I think even the Thorchain devs would be happy to admit that. They were very transparent about the whole thing and obviously stepped up big time and made a lot of changes to the way they operate in order to prevent that sort of thing from happening again. And it was ChaosNet, you know, that kind of was the point. But, you know, the amount of money involved was still very serious. And so I think before we deployed this product, we've been doing test nets for 2 years now. You know, we've found every edge case imaginable by doing that. And test nets are hairy places, you know, like since deploying to mainnet, the number of issues we found is zero because we've been watching Bitcoin rotations fail in every imaginable way for like 6 months now. And that's one example. So, you know, really long blocks, reorgs, all that kind of stuff. We've seen it all on the testnet. It's chaos out there. Yeah, but not ChaosNet, exactly. Another thing we did, which was really cool, this is initiative of our new CTO, Martin, is we built this tool called Bouncer, which will basically take a version of the code, it will build it, it will then deploy it across a brand new network running on cluster, like sort of a small cluster, and it will then basically just throw stuff at the network. It will do swaps, it will put liquidity in, it will take it out, it'll do all, we've got this whole suite of tests and this all just runs automatically. So now whenever we submit new code to be reviewed, not only is it reviewed manually by other engineers, but it's also thrown through the Bouncer as well, which will tell you if you're getting in or getting or not getting in based on the results of that test. So through that, we've been able to catch so much and do it so quickly as well. Our iteration speed since that's been introduced has been phenomenal because now there is just very little overhead associated with actually rigorously testing everything that we put out there. And I think that's a big reason why we just did an audit with Zelic, who are a pretty reputable firm. They've got more of a sort of white hat, but you know, sort of adversarial view of things rather than looking too much at the code. And they did look at a lot of the code, and they told us that it was a very frustrating audit, but that's a good thing because we don't have much to tell you, honestly. There was one thing, but we found it. We found a bad bug. I think there's a whole, I've already spoken about this maybe a bit too long, but security is a really tough conversation, and there's a lot more to it than people realize. It's not just audits or bug bounty programs. You know, if that's what you're talking about, you're barking up the wrong tree, because the conversation's got to happen a lot earlier than that, and it's really down to processes and systems between engineers above all, and that's just something that doesn't really get talked about too much in the space.
Yeah, that makes sense. So now from the end user perspective, how does ChainFlip work, and like what can you do? So from to really quick describe like the basic Thorchain, Maya, whatever else kind of experience is, obviously you go to a swap screen in most interfaces. Usually you have to connect a wallet, that's before memoless swaps, and then you can go swap, and then it kind of works just pretty well with your connected wallet. You can also provide liquidity and do that whole thing. You can also earn single-sided yield, and then for Thorchain you can also get do lending, which I kind of call longing your asset anyway. It's a little bit, maybe a little bit more accurate to my mind, but whatever. So that's just kind of like what the user can do with that and how it looks. How is it really different with ChainFlip?
Well, it's not that different. I mean, it's achieving a similar effect. I mean, we've got a few nice things that I think Thorchain still hasn't done, like, you know, limit orders on the LP side. We'll have a similar thing in place for front-end users as well. We'll also, you know, have some different chains as well. So that's another conversation. Like, we're doing Solana at the moment, which is something we're really excited about, because that's been a pretty under represented chain in this native cross-chain space, and the bridges that currently offer support for it are a nightmare to use, frankly speaking. I think that's going to be a big opportunity there. But you know, from a user's perspective, you know, what do they want when they do a swap? They want to do it cheaply. They don't want to get screwed. They don't want to pay a ton of gas, and they want it done quickly. And so everything that we've done over the last 2 years in terms of changing and evolving the design are in those three interests. So even from the memoless transactions thing, there are gas savings involved in that, because we're not posting random information about a trade into a memo along with the deposit that's being made to wherever it's being made. So that's a nice feature. There's a bunch of other stuff too. But you know, from a user perspective, I don't think it's swapping, you know, everyone's seeing Uniswap at this point. Anyone who's used Thorchain knows how that works at this point. And anyone that goes to swap.chainflip.io, I hope will have a pretty nice experience as well. It's all explained to you. It's very straightforward. But at the end of the day, what users, I think one sort of approach that I think we've taken early on, that obviously ThorChain has spent a lot of time working on ThorFi, which is catering to a different audience, is that we just kind of said, look, you know what? These are cool products. Like, you can earn yield on your assets, or you can, you know, you call it longing, lending, whatever, LP them, you know, whatever it is. We just decided we're not doing any of that. You know, that we don't see how this really fits into the JIT AMM model at this point. And so, you know, from an LP perspective, like, you can provide liquidity if you want, but I promise you, you're going to get better yield on ThorChain as a retail user. If you don't have a bot hooked up to it, forget about it. It's just not going to compete with, the guys on ThorChain, Chainflip. That said, I will say, I know all the guys that are LPing on Chainflip. And if you are handy with bots, I guarantee you will make money. It's pretty basic. You can do it. There's definitely opportunities there. We've got some new features coming up soon as well, which will create further opportunities still with different strategies. So there's definitely ways to contribute to the protocol in a more advanced way. But we don't offer any of those sort of retail-oriented DeFi products other than swapping, which is what we're here to do. Swapping, at the end of the day, volume and fees associated with that volume is what drives this entire ecosystem of decentralized exchanges. You know, that at the end of the day is the end goal. And the best way we can attract as many users as possible away from the centralized exchanges and towards us is by offering a product that is faster, cheaper, better, and more convenient than anything that a SEX could possibly hope to create. And I think, largely speaking, that's what we've done. And I hope that lots of people will get a very positive experience out of it. And I think Uniswap's proven without a doubt that there is a massive market for that. If you can do something that is competitive, people will just use it. Like, I don't, whenever I want to swap my USDs around or my ETHs around, I use CowSwap every time. It's just better. Which does rely on Uniswap to an extent, but again, further optimizations is cheaper. I get better rates. You know, this is what I care about as a user. I've been trading crypto now for 10 years. This is what I want. It's not rocket science, you know?
Yeah. That is interesting also that there's a certain element of not competing on some things, definitely competing on the swap element, trying to be the best in possible that, but also just saying, we're not trying to be, I guess, a retail focused yield generator, sort of. We're just here to give the end user product, the basic user could kind of do that. Whereas, like, if you think about sort of like home mining versus mining farms, like, you can, mining of any cryptocurrency could be profitable if you're a professional, but some cryptocurrencies really prioritize letting the little guy mine in their room or whatever. And it's kind of an interesting, you know, a professionalization, I guess, of the DEX world, if I could call it that.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why was Polkadot selected as the first non-Bitcoin or ETH kind of chain to start with? And what other than, you mentioned Solana, but then other than that, what's kind of the supported chain roadmap in your mind?
We did Polkadot because we're built on Substrate. So it's the same thing. We know how it works inside out. It was easy to do. Why not? We did it before Bitcoin even, because, you know, it's just something a lot closer to home. It didn't take that long. Will it be the highest volume market in Chainflip? Like, we're literally the only DEX supporting DOT, like, natively. Mm. In existence, and I'm still not bullish on it being particularly useful, but, you know, we'll see. Maybe I'll be surprised, but that was why. It's because we're Substrate junkies and we can't get enough. but then we did Bitcoin, and then we did Arbitrum as well. We got that on a testnet, but then we were like, nah, screw it, we're launching the mainnet. That's going to one side for now. We're now catching that back up to where it needs to be. That's going in. The reason that's going in is because although it's EVM and it's compatible with our contracts and stuff like that, there is some weirdness around it because there's a sequencer and it just spams blocks at you. So a lot of the core assumptions about how witnessing worked and all that kind of stuff sort of fell out the window. So we had to kind of refactor a lot of that stuff to allow for this new EVM chain to come along. But the reason we're doing it is because on the aggregator market, if someone's coming to or from any other EVM chain supported in that sort of constellation of Axela, Layer Zero, Wormhole, whatever, all 60 of those EVM chains and, you know, your Celestias and Eigenlayers and whatever the hell else people are using these days, people want to go in and out of Bitcoin with that. They're going to have to, without having Arbitrum, which is a cheap roller, people are going to have to pay to ingress into USDC on the ETH mainnet in order to use Chainflip, which is brutal. Mm-hmm. So we're sidestepping that by sort of having this EVM rollup over here that can talk to other cross-chain protocols as well, such as your Axelars, especially Axelar. Squid is our one of our launch partners. And they also have a connection to the IBC world as well, so all the Cosmos chains and stuff. So that'll all be aggregatable through our Arbitrum integration, which in turn gives us direct access to Polkadot, Bitcoin, and ETH at a very competitive rate, which is exciting. So that's something really cool that we think is going to make Chainflip a desirable option to have for all aggregators and a desirable leg on a route to and from some of these other assets that aren't really yet very well supported, including Solana, which is something that I'm also very excited about. Solana, again, lots and lots of liquidity on the centralized exchanges, very little, well, comparatively little on the decentralized exchanges, and bridging in and out of it is a nightmare. We're going to fix that by basically aggregating that really high centralized exchange liquidity and combining the bridging with that in a very low gas and very fast manner as well, to create what I think will be the best way to get in and out of the Solana ecosystem that exists today, just based on Chainflip's existing architecture. So again, very exciting opportunity, one I hope goes well.
Yeah.
But.
So that's kind of the roadmap then, is try to get Arbitrum pretty quickly, because that was kind of working on a test net, and then go to Solana, and that's kind of the next additions.
Yeah, well, I mean, the benefit of having 15 full-time engineers is we're doing a lot of this work in parallel. We also have three other new features on the go at the same time as well. So, you know, a lot of these features take 6 months to end to end, and we have to pick them up and put them down sometimes. But, you know, after 3 years of development, we have so many amazing people that, you know, can basically jump around to whatever project is going on inside the protocol team and, you know, figure out what we need to do next, and how we can advance along these different features. So we're actually working on both Solana and Arbitrum at the moment, as well as a new order type and a whole new system for ingress, which will speed it up dramatically, as well as gas fee optimizations. The product team is working on, you know, new information pages for LPs and all sorts of stuff. And the market making team, our own internal market making team, JRT Strategies, is preparing to be able to fill 100K swaps instantaneously in just a couple of weeks' time. So it's all systems go around here all the time. We're never quite sure how it's all going to get, in what order it's going to be released, and what problems we're going to discover along the way. So we kind of just sort of have a rolling roadmap and sort of just try to feel our way through the priorities as we go along.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And so how has it been so far after launch? Just smooth sailing, everything's nice, faster than you thought.
I want to give you a good story. I really do, but I have nothing to say. It's been shockingly quiet. I mean, compared to like the rate of breaking stuff and iterating that we had in the lead up to the launch, I think there's been like one sort of hairy, maybe kind of issue that turned out to not really be too big of a deal. There was a edge case in Bitcoin witnessing that we hadn't yet discovered. I think someone sent, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like someone quite legitimately sent multiple, they did something funky with Bitcoin. I think they sent from two different wallets or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is. It was a bit of a weird edge case, but you know, we almost didn't witness that, and we had to like sort of add some stuff in the engine to make sure that we would pick that up in the future. But that was it. That's one thing, and it's been a couple months now. So, crazy smooth.
Crazy smooth is kind of a good thing. So other than the new chain additions that are being worked on, anything exciting coming up over the next year, maybe two, that you want to point out for everyone?
Yeah, well, we're sort of in a pre-release phase at the moment. That's what we're calling it. In reality, most of the functionality is all already there. The thing that isn't there is any external aggregators being integrated into Chainflip yet. So we don't really have any significant volume. And therefore, the incentive to have liquidity there isn't quite at where we want it to be yet either. In just a few weeks' time, we're sort of around the 10-week time frame, we'll be integrated into a bunch. We'll be integrated into a whole bunch of places, some of which you may already know about. We've been in talks with a lot of the people that ThorChain have also been talking to over the years, as many new partners as well. Sort of the big thing coming up for us in the next 10 weeks or so is the opportunity to be able to offer liquidity for users of many different wallets, many different aggregators, and so on as well. So opening up new markets as well, exposing new users to the possibility of doing native Bitcoin swaps, native Solana swaps, and so on. So for us, I think, the next 6 months is really about scaling up Chainflip from being this, nice protocol that no one really uses to being sort of, thought of in the same way that ThorChain currently is about, being sort of an integral player in that space and definitely established with solid daily base volumes. And then from there, we can expand from that and continue the feature set. But over the next year, I think that there's going to be a lot of development that's going to go into optimizing that as well. We can continue working on everything from gas optimizations, market optimizations, and so on, increasing the extent of cross-chain messaging capability that we have on these new chains so that we can allow aggregator partners to then aggregate across the DEXs on the new chains that we're working on as well. So yeah, I mean, at this point, it's kind of just like take it 6 months at a time, figure out what the market wants, figure out what the market needs, and develop the protocol further from there. But I think this is going to be an endless story that doesn't stop for God knows how long, but it's very exciting, whatever it is.
Yeah, the cross-chain world is quite interesting. Never would have thought it would be quite like this, where it's almost, the base chain is almost, not important as far as like how anything can go into anything any number of times. And it'll be interesting to see what happens when the end user starts to completely lose visibility of the chain that they're actually using for anything, because they might use three different chains in the space of a few transactions, and it's the same, say, for example, asset, like a Bitcoin wrapped thing or a stablecoin or something, and they'll have used a few different networks and not even know it.
Yeah, that's actually something that I have a somewhat controversial opinion on.
Let's hear it then.
I think that future's dead, so dead in the water. I mean, this is what people were talking about with rollups, just in the Ethereum community, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, we've got rollups, this execution can happen over here and then they can do this over here. And like, that is just completely untrue. That never happens ever. The process of moving from one place to another sucks. You have USDC on this chain here, you got some ETH on this chain over here, it's a nightmare. And it sucks for users, People are talking about which rollup are people moving to. That is not that was not the vision that was sold about how this would help with Ethereum scalability. It didn't do anything to help with Ethereum scalability. It just multiplied the number of Ethereums out there. So I think this whole idea that people are going to have they're not going to care which chain they're on or whatever, that they're going to grab their NFT and interact with some other chain over there with some other protocol to do something with it there. That's not how blockchains work. These are sovereign environments. And the whole point is that you can't interact with state that you're not aware of, is a very simple reality. So you can move value from one place to another, but there's absolutely no reason why, Ethereum should care about some Solana NFT. That's just fundamentally not how it works. So I think the real challenge is, how do we create tools in place to make it easy to get from one place to the other? But I think this idea that, we'll be doing a the idea that you can somehow save gas by like swapping mainnet USDC, for example, mm-hmm. to mainnet ETH. There is no way to make that more efficient other than doing it off chain. And even then, you still have to pay gas on the way in and out. No rollups or multi-chain stuff anywhere will not solve this problem. And so I just don't think this idea of, users won't even know what chain they're on. They better damn well know what chain they're on, because otherwise they're going to end up like me with assets in a million different places, and they'll lose track of it and never find it again. Like, we shouldn't be telling people this story because it's dangerous, you know. This isn't sharding. It's not how it works. It's
fragmentation.
Yeah, we should care. We should care where we are interacting. And there is a lot to be said for network effects around particular networks for particular activities. And I think for me, the sort of IBC Polkadot idea of app chains and stuff is something I'm much more highly subscribed to, obviously, having built mm-hmm. one myself. I can see the power and the utility of not having to worry about standardized rules of execution in a single environment. So I think mobility rather than interoperability is really the key problem that we can make a big contribution to. And that mobility about being able to string together transactions across from one destination to another and automate that and make that efficient and cheap. You know, that's really, in my opinion, the real goal that we as cross-chain DEXs and cross-chain people should be striving for: mobility, not interoperability, because I think the interoperability thing is a lie, frankly speaking.
Interesting. So you think that then this cross-chain ecosystem that's kind of developing of cross-chain swaps might actually start to reduce the number of different chains we're dealing with for redundant purposes? So like, there, instead of, now you have the average user might say they're trying to buy a gift card from Bitrefill or something. They might use USDC on, or USDT on Tron, or also on Solana, on Arbitrum, on Polygon, on Avalanche, on that, all that kind of thing. Is, do you think that it'll have the effect of kind of narrowing those down, those kind of redundant use cases, to like fewer chains?
No, I think that users will create as many and use as many chains as they want. There'll be incentives and reasons to use as many different platforms as exist. But I think the problem that we have to busy ourselves with is to make it easy for users to go and send that deposit to some other protocol to use it there. We shouldn't be saying that, you know, I can keep my balance here and then interact. No, you still need to have a wallet on that other chain. Like, you still need to sign for it. You need to get there. We can get you there, but you still need to get you there. That's kind of what I'm saying, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Bold yet nuanced. Very specific. The best, not like indiscriminate smack talking where, you know, you have external casualties or whatever. Yeah, well, this has been a fantastic chat. Where can people find more about you and about Chainflip and start using
it? You can follow me on Twitter at Simon A. Harmon. Probably easier though to just go to chainflip.io and follow the links there. Websites are wonderful repositories of information. They have lots of links and white papers and Discords and documents and stuff. So I'm gonna send you straight there. Chainflip.io. Would love to see you in the community as well. If you're interested in learning more about what we do and how it works, I'm in the chat all the time. So if you got anything you want to ask, feel free. And thanks once again for having me, man. It's been a fun chat, or a bit of ranting on my side, perhaps. But what's a good podcast without a good rant, eh?
Yeah, it's kind of why they're long form, right? To have the room for this. All right, well, thanks for being on, everyone, and thanks for watching, everyone.